Looks like I'm the one keeping you from the barbecue.
Barbecue is 5 hours.
Okay, no, don't worry. It's not going to extend till that. But I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me here and giving me this opportunity to present my work. So the topic of the talk today is non-equilibrium dynamics of ultracold bosons in optical lattice. It's a collection of looking at non-equilibrium dynamics in two separate boson systems. And so here is a overview of the talk. So first I'm going to, there would be a short introduction on ultracold bosons, which is probably unnecessary for the audience here. Then I'm going to talk about RAM dynamics of the Bose-Savart model. In particular, I would like to introduce a projection operator method for treating the dynamics of the Bose-Savart model in the strong coupling regime. And we'll show that when that method and also mean field theory is used to treat periodic dynamics of the model, we find this phenomenon of dynamic freezing, which I'm going to explain. And then the second part of the talk, if I have time, would be on bosons in a quote-unquote electric field. So there's been some earlier theories and experiment, and what I want to show is a work with Brian here and others, that there is the dynamics of these bosons in an electric field is a nice way to show Keeble-Zurek scaling in finite size system. Okay. And before I move on, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators. So Anirban Dutta is a graduate student who is working with me. Christian Trevsger, now at France. David and Brian, you know. Michael, who is at Princeton right now, and Shreyoshi, who was my graduate student and now at Max Planck, German. So let's start with something very basic. This is the Emmanuel Bloch experiment in 2001, which started all of this. So you start with a bosons in a trap and then ramp up a lattice potential. So if the potential is small, you see superfluidity. If it is quite large, you see complete delocalization in momentum space, which in turn was interpreted as localized bosons in real space, which is the signature of the Mott insulator. Somewhere in between you have peak, which was interpreted as a phase transition between the superfluid and the insulator. So to look at this, if one wants to construct a really simple model, the way to do this is to recognize that in the presence of counterpropagating laser, which is standing wave of light, the atoms feel a potential which is proportional to the intensity of the laser. And this leads to atoms sitting at the bottom of the wave of light, this crests. And for a deep enough potential, the atoms would be localized because it's simply difficult to go to the next site. And this situation can be modeled by a simple Bose-Savart type of model where there is an on-site interaction term, which tells that if you put two atoms on the same site, then there is an interaction energy. And a hopping term, which tells you that there is an energy gain if the atoms go from one side to the other. Typical numbers for here tells you that the single particle energy states within the same well is really far apart compared to U, and hopping can be made really small compared to U. So you could actually go into the regime where U is the largest scale in the problem, and you are okay to deal with single particle, a single band Hubbard model. So this Hubbard model is really well known, and people have looked at it in all details. So so just to understand how these things work, so imagine that you are really in the limit where hopping J is zero, and then because of the interaction, when your chemical potential is between zero and U, you have one boson per site. Now imagine trying to add a particle over this Mott state. To add this, you pay an energy cost, which is U minus mu. But once you have added this, this particle can hop, and this gives you an energy lowering, which in case of a particle is two times the number of coordination number, which is the number of nearing neighbor site to this site, times the hopping. And so there is a critical hopping above which this energy becomes less than zero, which means that the Mott state is destabilized. You could do a similar thing with hole and get a critical hopping for the holes, and whichever is lower gives you the critical hopping at which the Mott state is destabilized in favor of a superfluid. Now, this argument, which is really very simple and not quantitatively accurate, could be sort of made more accurate using several things. For example, to calculate the energy of the Mott state, you could include virtual processes. That was done by Frerichs and Monian. People have looked at this transition using mean field theory and also numerically using quantum Monte Carlo. So there have been several, you know, works. I've just listed a few names. But all of this predicts a quantum phase transition between the Mott insulator and the superfluid with a dynamical critical exponent 2, except at the tip of the Mott lobe, where the transition occurs without a change of density and has a dynamical critical exponent 1. Now, the point is that the reason why this dynamical critical exponent change at the tip of the Mott lobe is that there is an additional particle symmetry at this point, which changes this exponent. However, in all of this method, except the mean field theory, there is no obvious way of generalizing them to study non-equilibrium dynamics. And so what we wanted to do is to get a method which is a little bit more accurate than the mean field theory, but nevertheless can be used to treat the dynamics of this model.
So what's the physics of that pointy phase diagram?
Oh, that's just you calculate this particle and hole addition energy and try to calculate TC from there. Those are just these two lines, I think, this and that.
Okay, so that's the phase boundary does have this sharp corner.
It's just a sharp corner because you haven't put in this particle hole, you know, mixing processes, actually. And that's mean field. Okay.
By mean field, you mean Gutsuna?
Yeah, something. Okay, so the approach that we took is that suppose you have the Mott state and you look at the state with one boson per site. Now it turns out that now if I look at the hopping term, this can be distinguished, the types of hoppings that you can have, this can be distinguished into two separate classes depending on the state from where you start from. So if you start from the Mott state with one particle per site, this hopping is going to take you to a state with additional particle in the next site and a hole here. But this state is an energy U above the Mott state. And therefore, this type of hopping takes you out of the low energy manifold of the problem. However, there is another type of hopping where you start from a state with an additional hole, and these states are important near the critical point, and there the hopping doesn't take you out of the low energy subspace. So what we attempted to do using a projection operator, which is defined in this, is to sort of distinguish between these two type of hopping processes. In particular, using this projection operator, you could write hopping into a term which to the one which takes you out of the low energy manifold and another term which keeps you within the low energy manifold. And once this is done, the rest of it is pretty well-known thing. What you can do is to find out a canonical transformation which will eliminate the hopping processes via Schiffer-Wolf kind of transformation, the hopping processes which takes you out of the low energy manifold. And it turns out that it's not too hard to calculate this canonical transformation operator. Turns out to be just the commutator of the projection and the hopping operators. And then one obtains the effective Hamiltonian using this. Okay, so that's the effective Hamiltonian. It has the on-site terms, the hopping which doesn't take you out of the low energy manifold, and other quote-unquote J squared over U kind of terms, but they are analog for the bosonic systems. Okay. So now to compute the energy from this, we recognize that the energy is the expectation of the original Hamiltonian from psi, but this is just this, the expectation of the effective Hamiltonian with respect to psi prime, where psi prime and psi differs by this factor e to the power is. S is the canonical transformation operator, and this is accurate up to order J square over U. Now, once you do this, to make further progress, you need to choose a psi prime. And we note that, so we notice that, you know, when J is 0, that's the hopping coefficient is 0 in the atomic limit, so to speak, S is 0, and therefore psi prime and psi must be the same, and this is a Gertz-Wheeler, this is well, this is really a Gertz-Wheeler wave function, Because if you don't have J, I mean, then you can just take product states. And therefore, we choose psi prime to be a Gutzwiller form. However, this doesn't mean that within this formalism, the real wave function is Gutzwiller form, because you build in special correlation by putting in an S. Okay. And this is done order by order in perturbation theory. We go up to second order here. And it turns out that the phase diagram that you obtain from here is reasonably accurate, and you can check this. It compares quite well to Monte Carlo in D equal to 3 for square lattices, and it's really accurate for large coordination number, but it gets pretty accurate when it comes to 2D and, you know. So, but the thing to do with this is next to look at the dynamics. So we consider a linear ramp, J of t, which is of the following form. So it starts from an initial value Ji, which is somewhere in the superfluid phase, and goes to a final value Jf, which will be in the mod phase. And this is done with a rate 1 over tau. Okay. So to solve this, we need to solve this dynamics, which is difficult because there are lots of states. But now the idea is to make a time-dependent canonical transformation of the following form, so that the Schrodinger equation can be written in this form. Okay. So now what happens is that we have this extra term, which tells you that how S changes with time, because we are doing a time-dependent transformation. However, now we can describe the dynamics in terms of H star, the effective Hamiltonian, and by solving an equation for psi prime, which we know, which we have taken to be the Gutzwiller form. And therefore, when you do this, you can translate this into an equation for the Gutzwiller coefficient, which is just that. And this phi here is the expectation of the boson. It's really the superfluid order parameter. Capital phi, although it doesn't appear here probably, but it's somewhere hidden in there, is expectation of B square.
So,
yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
Does the so if I start with something initially in one of these Gutzwiller forms, does it stay in that form at all times because of this DSDT, or out of that form?
F prime, psi prime will always be of the Gutzwiller form, yeah. But psi need not be. Okay, so that's the.
So the second, so everything except the first term is the usual Gutzwiller approximation. Is that correct?
Everything except the first term. No, the first term is.
So everything, the rest is the usual Gutzwiller. Is that, do I understand the notation?
I'm sorry, which?
That
equation, okay.
Yeah.
Which term are you?
So
this is different because this comes from del S del T, the rest is Gutzwiller. Is that what you?
So the first, everything except the first term is Gutzwiller.
The first term meaning this?
Yeah, everything else is the usual.
No, the other way around. The first term is what you have in a Gutzwiller, because this is the derivative of the energy with respect to F star. I mean, that's always going to come.
Wait, so new term is the first term in the brackets, right? In each of the
new term is the second term in the right, which is basically this, I think.
The second term in the brackets?
That's del S del T, you know, that's the term which is different here. Okay, so the first term out here comes from this, okay, the derivative acting on psi. This part comes from H JT psi, so that will just translate into the derivative. And these two would be there even if you do mean field theory, you know. But the other term, this del S del T, that comes from, that gives to this set of terms.
But some of these terms in the del S del T, they look just like renormalizations of some of the Gutzwiller terms, right?
Well, not really. It has this order parameters and stuff. I mean, it will have some. Okay. So we look at, so we use this, and now that we know the coefficients, we can construct back the wave function psi and calculate whatever quantities we want to calculate. So we compute the residual energy and this quantity, which is F, you know, we call it the wave function overlap. And it turns out that this F shows a, okay, so let's talk about this residual energy. It shows a plateau and not a scaling form. And the reason for this is that this method doesn't really address the k equal to 0 mode near the transition, because you build special correlation order by order in J over U. And k equal to 0 mode is really difficult out here. Okay, so the Kibble-Zurek kind of scaling is not in this picture. However, for dynamics which is not very slow, and that's what is, I believe, seen in the experiments, this is the type of plateau that you would also see, which I'm going to show in the next slide. You could also compute things like oscillations of the order parameter. Near the transition, this has just a single frequency because it's either the particle creation or the hole creation frequency. However, if you go deep inside the superfluid phase, the evolution occurs with multiple frequencies, and this gives you a complicated pattern. So you could take the time period of this oscillation and plot it as a function of the quench parameter J, and this shows a divergence at the critical point, which is an example of critical slowing down. And you could also compute things like this, which are correlation of the order parameter.
So you got a linear ramp in J, right?
No, this is for this part. Here I am doing a sudden quench. So I change from Ji to Jf suddenly and then look at the subsequent dynamics, and this part is...
Which value of Ji, Jf? So you are from month to month?
No, this depends. So Jf, so you see here the points, this is your values of Jf, and I think we start always at some value of the mod state.
Okay.
What
was the critical J in
this
unit?
I'm sorry, what was the one?
Is critical J
is
zero.
Critical J is right around here. It's around 0.03 or something like that.
It's one dimensional.
It's in 3D actually. So this method is somewhat like building fluctuation systematically over mean field theory, and therefore it's really good in 3D and higher dimensions, but it's really bad in 1D. I mean, if you compare numbers. And so qualitatively, you know, this defect density also shows a plateau. There are some experiments, and this is just a qualitative match. So, you know, no things about that. But the thing is, one thing that I would like to say is that this ramp times in the experiments go all the way from, let's say, 0.2 milliseconds to 20 milliseconds. The typical time scale associated with hopping near the superfluid insulator critical point is of the order of 70 milliseconds, TH over JC. So this dynamics is still very fast. So the fact that they don't see this Kivel-Zurek scaling in the experiment is expected. You know, it's not. And the thing is that in this regime, this plateau-like behavior is reproduced by the theory, but I believe that if you go to really slower ramps, then this theory, which doesn't capture k equal to 0 mode, is going to deviate from the experiments. Okay, so we also did some power law ramping, and you know, so you see this plateau, but the rate at which you approach the plateau differs, and which is not down. So let me now talk about the periodic protocol, where we change this j as a function of time, but as a cosine function. Okay, so we start here. The protocol is this: we start from the superfluid phase, go inside the mod phase, and come back. Okay, and that's this ramp. And the key result is that what we found is that there are specific frequencies at which the wave function of the system almost comes back to itself after a cycle of the drive, which leads to an almost perfect wave function overlap. Okay. And this is seen when you plot this 1 minus wave function overlap out here, and you see that the log p goes all the way till almost minus 5. And the residual energy and the order parameter stays roughly constant over a range, whereas this wave function overlap becomes close to zero only at fixed frequencies.
So the residual energy is the energy created after one period.
After one period, yes. Everything is after one period here. So to understand this phenomenon, we first used a mean field analysis. Okay, so let's just see what happens in the mean field, and then we'll go into other projection operator approach. So in the mean field, we start with a Gutzwiller wave function, and this is your mean field equation. Now, since we are always in the superfluid phase near the transition, or in the mod phase during the dynamics, all the wave function amplitudes are really in the three states, n equal to 2, n equal to 1, and n equal to 0. And this can be explicitly numerically checked by keeping more coefficients, that coefficients of f3, f4, etc. are really very close to 0. To that end, we simplify this equation by just looking at the evolution of f0, f1, and f2. And these are the equations which governs the dynamics of F0, F1, and F2 with the assumption that F3 is close to 0. The first thing that one notices with this equation is that if I now from here, if I attempt to write down the equation of amplitude of F0, F1, and F2, which are these RNs that I define here, these amplitudes satisfy a rule that the evolution rate of change of F0 and F2 are equal, and they are half negative half of change of rate of F1. Okay. Now this tells you that the amplitudes of the states 2 and 0 can be related to that of 1 up to a parameter which is determined by an initial condition. Okay. Now this tells you that once you know the equation for F R1, for example, you don't need to really bother about solving equations for R2 and R0. They are known in this term. Okay. Therefore, what was a set of equations in 6 real variables now comes to a set of equation in 3 real variables, one for the amplitude of R1 and the other two for the sum and difference of the two relative phases between the state number state 1 and 0 and number state 1 and 2. Okay, so phi 0 minus phi 1. Okay, so those are the. So the thing to note here is that the first two equations, which deals with the amplitude and the sum of the relative phases, they don't involve phi d. Okay, these are independent set of equations. And if I scale time by the frequency of the drive, omega, I could find a frequency independent relation between R1 and phi s out here. This means that if there is a frequency, if there is a range of frequency where R1 stays close to its initial value after a drive, so would phi s. Okay. This oscillation seems large here, but these are really very small. And as I said, this overlap is approximately equal to 1, not quite equal to 1. Now, once this is understood, we look at what happens when I what happens to phi d, that is the difference of the relative phase during this period. Phi d evolves according to some monotonic function of time, or rather omega, and the values at which phi d over 4 pi hits an integer, you see that since phi s is close to 0, both of these frequencies are close to 2 pi, and therefore you have the wave function coming back to its older value up to a global phase. So R1 is close to its initial value, and so is phi d, and phi s is close to 0, which is its initial value, and phi d is some 4 pi times an integer. So at these values of the frequency, where at which phi d over 4 pi is n, you see a wave function overlap, which is very close to 1. And those are the dips. Those are those dips out there. Okay. However, quantities like q and delta, they can be shown to be independent of the relative phase difference, and they remain very close to 0 for a large values of for a range of value of omega over j, not at specific frequency, because they just depend on the amplitude and the. So the other thing that I wanted to point about this is that we have done this using mean field theory, and then we thought that it's an artifact of mean field theory. So we did the same thing using projection operator approach. The plots are almost identical, except that the numbers, that's the frequency at which these things happen, I mean the wave function overlap goes to 1, those numbers change, but qualitatively the phenomenon remains. And then there is some numerical work which David did, which was simulating this entire thing in a trap system. And this is done with a two-dimensional trap system with linear dimension 24, if I remember correctly. And for small enough drive, we find that there is, there is still this freezing phenomenon which is out there. So, trapped system mean field theory and non-trapped systems, both mean field theory and the projection operator, all tells you that this freezing phenomenon works. Of course, what happens beyond this in a slight more sophisticated way of taking into account fluctuations, that I do not know, but it would be nice to have a method like that.
So yeah. At this point, you're saying the delta goes to 1,
very close to 1.
And so what is the energy doing?
Energy actually, okay, so the overlap depends on both the relative and the sum of the, okay, so both the sum and the difference of the relative phases.
Okay.
So it goes to close to 1 at specific frequencies. However, the energy doesn't depend on the difference of the relative phases. Okay, so it goes to very close to 0 over a range.
Very close to 0?
Over a range.
It
doesn't absorb energy.
Okay.
So, yeah, I was talking to Emmanuel and we were thinking if one could understand this in terms of a parametric resonance phenomenon of some sort, but I don't know, you know, because this is really strongly interacting system and I don't have a way of, at least for, until now, don't see a way of writing that. Okay, so I'm going to switch over to the next part of the talk. So I have 15 minutes. Okay, good. So I think I'm going to finish early. So which is about bosons in an electric field. So this is started long time back when I was a postdoc at Yale. When the first part of the work is done with Steve Garvin and Subi Sachdev. So what we looked at is that, again, bosons in a mod phase, but now you apply a quote-unquote electric field to these bosons. But of course, these bosons are neutral. By electric field, what I mean is that you could probably shift the center of the trap a little bit because it's a parabolic trap. Shifting the center gives you a linear term in the energy of these bosons, which is like an electric field. Or you could do this using Zeeman field as the experiments in Marcus Greiner's group have done. But the idea is to add a linear term in the boson Hamilton, okay, and this can be done. So the idea is that the difference with standard condensed matter systems here is that the electric field can be strong enough to the scale of U. And this is something one can never achieve without having electric breakdown in condensed matter systems. So here is a construction of a model. So we looked at a chain of 1D bosons in their mod state and in the presence of this electric field. And here is a cartoon where this is sort of the electric field, so the energy is going down. And the bosons have a hopping term, on-site interaction, and this electric field term. And this is the density of the bosons. And we are going to work in the regime where the electric field and the on-site interaction both are strong. However, the difference between the electric field and the interaction that could be small, and W is a small quantity. W is the hopping here. Okay. So how do you solve such a system? First of all, you know, this is not the ground state of a system, because as you can see, the ground state of the system would be the one in which, for at least for large E, everything goes to the the rightmost state. However, it so turns out that these are systems which are like single band Hubbard model, and the single particle band which is above the minimum band is quite up there, which is a large energy scale compared to the electric field. Therefore, the time scale for the electric breakdown in which a boson starts to go to the next site and tumble down, that's a very large time scale. And in this case, it turns out it's larger than the system lifetime. Okay. So one could think of these as a metastable state and then try to formulate a theory around this metastable state.
Yes. Yes. So if the system is isolated, why isn't that stable? Why is it not just stable? Because for the boson to tumble down, some other boson has to climb up. Is that?
Yeah, but you could imagine fluctuation process in very long time which would do that, right?
I mean, I guess what I'm asking is that thinking about what the ground state is seems a bit strange because the ground state has a very different energy.
Yeah, grounds. This is not the ground state.
So why would I ever? But ground state is not reachable because of energy conservation, it seems.
Yeah, right.
The time state.
Yep.
But there's more ways to create more excitation.
Right.
At the same energy.
Yes.
That's why.
But the point is that the time, the important issue is the time it takes to go into that. So it turns out that so one needs to construct a low energy effective model which is going to describe the equilibrium, well, sort of the state, the dynamics around the state. And it turns out that the excitations which does this are the neutral dipoles, which means that a single boson hopping from one side to the other. Now this, well, the dipole is this extra boson and the hole here together, and this has an energy U minus E, because you know you pay an extra energy cost U because you go to the next state. However, you gain an energy E because of the electric field. And it turns out that these are resonantly coupled to the parent Mach state when U is equal to E. That's when the excitation gap disappears. So these are the basic excitations of the low energy excitations of the system. Now, one could not only have one dipole, but many such dipoles, each with an energy U minus E, which are, you know, sort of all of them going to zero at U equal to E. However, one should remember that two dipoles which are next to each other, that configuration is not allowed in this, because if this would involve a particle hopping to the next site and then again there, so which is like a dipole over two sites, okay? And this means that the energy lowering would be U minus 2E, which is way down, okay? And that's not a part of the low energy manifold. Those are the states you sort of forget about. And therefore, the effective Hamiltonian of the dipole is the following. So to create a dipole, you know, you have an energy cost of U minus E. And dipoles can be spontaneously created or destroyed because of the hopping. The hopping can take you up to the next site and spontaneously create the dipole. So this dipole energy conservation is not there in the basic Hamiltonian. The constraints are the following, that you cannot have more than one dipole on a given site because that's not a part of the low energy manifold, and you cannot have two dipoles on neighboring sites. Okay, so if you have a dipole on the site on a link L, you cannot have a dipole on the link L plus one because that's not a part of the low energy manifold either. So this Hamiltonian, so what we did in the old work is to determine the phase diagram of HD as a function of this parameter U minus E by W. And it's pretty, the ends of this are pretty obvious. If the electric field is weak, then what we have is the ground state is a vacuum for these dipoles, so nothing moves. And then, you know, you have lowest energy excitations, which can be seen to be single band of dipole excitations, which softens as E approaches U. And there are higher excited states. However, in strong electric field, the situation is completely different. So the ground state is a state of maximum dipoles. But here, there is this difference that you could form dipoles at the odd sites or the even sites. And therefore, the ground state would, but not both. And therefore, the ground state spontaneously breaks Z2 symmetry. This is very reminiscent of the Ising model, where this is sort of like the ferromagnetic phase, and the other one is the paramagnetic phase. And indeed, in between, we did find a transition, which was a quantum phase transition with, you know, all Ising exponents. Okay.
So we did. So you are solving the Bose-Hubbard model or the Ising model?
No, this is the dipole model. So it's a phase transition of the dipole model. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's not the Bose-Hubbard phase transition. Okay, we are always in the Mott state, but the transition is sort of going from a maximal dipole state, which is a configuration like 0 2 0 2 for the, well, if you had the uniform state to be one particle per site.
No, but the question is, what is the difference between the true Hamiltonian and the Hamiltonian that you are considering?
Well, this is a low energy effective Hamiltonian for describing the true system inside the Mott phase and in the presence of a strong electric field. So the boson degrees of freedom, you know, in terms of this transition, imagine that you have a Mott state with one boson per site, okay? So the dipole vacuum would be one boson per site, nothing else. The other state, which is like the ferromagnetic state for this dipole, you know, all dipoles out there, that would be a state which is like zero boson, two bosons, and so on. And that's the transition, basically. It's like a density wave order for the bosons.
So in the, at the criticality, system becomes gapless with its Ising. So that could, in original Bose-Hubbard language, is it correspond to the corresponding to the superfluid phase or?
No, it's not. That doesn't correspond to the superfluid phase. It's the.
Is the breakdown?
No, it's sort of the. Okay, good question. What does that? So
is this Ising with transverse field or Ising with longitudinal?
It's Ising, but without the interaction term. It's. I'm going to show that in a moment. Okay. Okay, so there is this, you know, experiment at Reiner's group where they've seen this dipole pattern. Okay, and these are the, so here is the conversion between a spin and the dipole language. And these are the two terms which the dipole Hamiltonian captures. This term is a term of the order U, which is essentially implementing the constraint that you had no dipole, two dipoles at original sites. Okay, so this is really like an Ising model in longitudinal and transverse field, and therefore another reason why it is not exactly solvable. Okay. So the experiments are done right in this regime, and okay, so what's that? So what I want to now say in the last 5 minutes or so is that we looked at the dynamics of this dipole model. And this is pretty easy to do because it's a one-dimensional system. So you can write down the wave function and compute the expectation value of the dipole order parameter, which we did. And for the Quine's dynamics, the statement was that the amplitude of oscillation of the order parameter increases when the final electric field that you quench to is near the critical point. Okay, so you start from a dipole vacuum, you change your electric field to some value, and when that value is near the critical point, the amplitude oscillation increases. You can also compute the time average value of the order parameter at long times, and that shows a peak near the critical point, which was also shown. But now, after the experiment, we decided to look at the time-dependent electric field, which is a function, which is a ramp, and we computed several quantities like the residual energy, the number of excitation, the defect density, correlation function. And in particular, we looked at the possibility of having these Keble-Zurek scaling laws in these systems. Now, in infinite system, these scaling laws just depend on the rate. Okay, so it's rate to the power this power. However, these need to be modified in finite size systems, and the system size comes into play. And these are done by the following scaling functions. So one sees that, for example, the residual energy would scale as the rate square for very slow quenches, which is like the Landau-Zener behavior, whereas it would scale for linearly for intermediate quenches. And the fact that one doesn't see Keble-Zurek scaling at very low rates is a consequence of the fact that one has a finite size system. Okay, so you need to go above a fixed, above some finite rate. And we do find using both exact diagonalization and time-dependent matrix product states, we do find this expected scaling laws. So there is a, so the idea about this is to basically tell the experimentalist that there is a finite range of rates in which this Keble-Zurek scaling would be seen. However, it's not going to be seen if you go to really low rates where the Landau-Zener behavior of 1 over rate square is going to take over. And we did calculate the correlation function and the dipole dynamics, which can also be possibly verified in experiment. So to summarize, we looked at this different, well, non-equilibrium dynamics in different Bose-Savart systems, and apparently there are two separate systems that I talked to you about. One is the standard Bose-Savart model, where we studied the superfluid dynamics around the superfluid insulator transition. And the other one is deep inside the Mott phase, where you apply an electric field, and that's where, that's this dipole dynamics. Okay. So thank you for your attention.
Maybe a remark. So if you look at this a situation of a tilted mud insulator, actually you can use this dipole picture which you introduced to induce transport. And if you do it right, then you can get transport up the hill. So
well, really?
It's okay. Nice effect. You have to,
I see.
The modulator lattice is not supposed
to. Okay, thanks.
Maybe this relates to what Emmanuel was asking, but
yeah.
If I plot the complete spectrum of the tilted Bose-Hubbard lattice, then presumably this Ising effective model corresponds to some part in the middle of that spectrum.
Of course, states, there would be negative states, but that middle is where you are staying, and the sort of the low energy subspace, well, I wouldn't say low energy, but the subspace around that is what this thing captures. That's true, yeah, it's certainly going to be somewhere in the middle.
What's the translation to finite temperature?
I haven't looked at that actually. Not sure.
Oh, is this a quantum critical point? There has to be a...
Yeah, there has to be a fan and all that, but I haven't really looked at
it. How do you think about it? Is it sort of somehow the middle states are effectively...
Well, you need to...
Zero temperature, the far states are also zero temperature.
No. No, I don't think that's a way it would work. I'm not really sure how temperature is going to. So as long as the temperature doesn't take you out of that low energy manifold, you know, it would be like a standard quantum critical theory. But beyond that, I am not sure. And specifically, when the temperature starts inducing transition to the higher band, then all of this will break down. So I really don't know the detail. I mean, the quantitative details is not so clear because I haven't looked at that.
Around the same energy, you also have these states where everybody goes to the right.
That's way lower in energy, I would think.
No, but it ends excited somehow.
Sorry?
So you move them all to the right.
Yeah.
And you give them some energy.
Okay.
It's hardly anything.
No.
They don't have kinetic energy to give them, right?
They're deep inside the mott.
Narrow band.
Yes. It's a very narrow band because, you know, you were deep inside the mott and...
I have a question about the projection method. Does it apply to more complicated bands? See, we have a band of two minimals. Does this projection?
Yeah, it will. As long as you don't have traps, I mean, you could. So, in fact, this projection operator first came up with a very old study that I did with Steve at Yale. And there it was done for the two species Bose-Savart model. So, which is not too different from, you were probably thinking about the P-wave stuff, which also is two species.
I'm thinking about a single band with like two minimal. Something like a spin over cup, you have a spin over the cup of the band, and something like that.
Well, if you have a spin orbit coupling, then there must be two species of bosons, which the spin orbit couples. There has to be a spin, right?
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to say is that for a two species boson model, I mean, there is a way to generalize this projection operator approach. So I think Andreas Isaacson, Minchul, Cha, Steve, and I worked on this sometimes back. So the formalism is there. I mean, of course, applying it to, you know, specific system, that needs to be seen actually.